and thank you for that very generous introduction. Indeed, I will not be regaling you with my extraterritorial exploits. It's a great pleasure and honour to be back here. I do remember fondly my Fridays as an LLM student coming along to these seminars. I feel completely unworthy to be here as a lecturer myself, but it nonetheless is a great honour, and I do hope that you are, those of you who are LLM students, are enjoying your year here as much as I did. Today I'd like to talk about a judgment from this summer, the Alskaini decision of the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, but in the process I'm really going to look back over the Alskaini litigation saga in the English courts leading up to that decision in Strasbourg and consider the way in which the determinations from this summer fit within or depart from the determinations on the law that were made in the English courts. Determinations, I should say, with a link to your speaker from last week, which were greatly influenced by Professor Greenwood, as he was then, in his role as counsel in the litigation when it was going through the English courts. As many of you will know, this litigation ended up in the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, and the Grand Chamber took an unusually long period of time in its deliberation, and we had a decision in July this year. In the English courts, the case concerned the applicability of the Human Rights Act, which, of course, as we know, is an act of Parliament, to the UK presence in Iraq. And since in the English court decisions, the extraterritorial meaning of the Act was tied to that of the European Convention on Human Rights, the cases in the English courts actually involved a detailed consideration of the extraterritorial meaning of the Convention. When proceedings moved to Strasbourg, then the same overall legal question that had been the subject of extensive deliberations previously was again being addressed now directly, rather than because of its underlying relevance to the Human Rights Act. The case related to the period after the removal of Saddam Hussein, when the US and the UK were occupying Iraq. And in the words of the late Lord Bingham in the House of Lords decision, this case concerned, and I quote, the deaths of six Iraqi civilians and the brutal maltreatment of one of them causing his death in Basra. Each of the deceased was killed, or in one case is said to have been killed, and the maltreatment was inflicted by a member or members of the British Armed Forces, end of quote. Relatives of the deceased challenged the then UK Defence Secretary's refusal to order an independent inquiry into the deaths, and also his rejection of liability to afford redress for causing the deaths, on the basis of a right to such an inquiry and such redress when the right to life in Article 2 of the ECHR has been violated. This challenge therefore required a determination of whether there had been a violation of Article 2, which in turn required a determination of whether the obligation to secure this right even applies at all in the case of an extraterritorial situation like Iraq. This then required a consideration more generally of the extraterritorial application of the Convention. Now, the main treaties on civil and political rights, such as the ICCPR, the American Convention, and the European Convention, and their protocols, and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, don't conceive obligations simply in terms of the acts of state parties, as is the case, for example, under Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions. Instead, responsibility is conceived in a particular spatial context. The state is obliged to secure the rights contained in the treaties only in its jurisdiction. The ICCPR formulation is slightly different. We don't need to worry about that for present purposes. And there's a slightly different form of words in the Torture Convention. But it's clear from all of these arrangements that a particular nexus to the state, termed jurisdiction, has to be established before a act or a mission of that state is covered by the regulatory framework of the treaty. So as the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights stated in the Alskany decision of July, and I quote, jurisdiction is a threshold criterion. The exercise of jurisdiction is a necessary condition for a contracting state to be able to be held responsible for acts or omissions imputable to it, which give rise to an allegation of the infringement of rights and freedoms set forth in the Convention. End of quote. Several early human rights treaties, including the ECHR and its subsequent protocols, contain what's colloquially known as a colonial clause, allowing states parties to make declarations that the rights contained in the treaties will apply in, and to use the form of words, territories for whose international relations the states are responsible. That's to say, colonial and trust territories, now euphemistically termed dependencies or overseas territories. Similar extension clauses weren't included in the later human rights treaties, including the ICCPR, which therefore apply to states in their overseas territories on the same basis as they apply to those states in other extraterritorial contexts. That's to say, when the jurisdiction test is met. And I'll return to the question of whether, for other treaties that do have colonial clauses like the ECHR, the jurisdiction trigger can trigger applicability in overseas territories as an alternative to the operation of extension clauses. I'll come back to that in due course. Switching back to that concept of jurisdiction, this has been understood in the case law and other authoritative commentary as having a meaning in the extraterritorial context, rooted in a connection between the state on the one hand and either the territory in which the relevant acts take place, referred to as you would expect, the territorial or a spatial connection, or, as an alternative, the individual affected by them, again referred to often as the personal, individual, or, because of the type of state action involved, a state-agent-authority connection. So two types of connection can trigger jurisdiction extraterritorially. Now, before considering how these triggers were applied to the facts in Alskany, I should just flag up four of the main contested issues relating to this area of law. First of all, as we know, I don't need to go into it in great detail in this audience, an area of international law called jurisdiction also exists quite separately from the use of that word in international human rights law. We have to consider then what relevance that area of general international law has for understandings of the use of the same word in human rights treaties. And as we know, to simplify greatly, the international law concept of jurisdiction is concerned with rules prescribing the particular circumstances where a state is legally permitted to exercise its legal authority over a particular situation, for example, the operation of its criminal law. In the Bankovic decision of 2001, which Professor Greenwood was also involved in, concerning the NATO bombing of what was then the FRY, the European Court of Human Rights seemed to suggest that the meaning of jurisdiction in the Convention should somehow reflect the meaning of that word in public international law generally. So much then for the first issue. The second arises out of a dictum, again from that Bankovic case, as it was applied in the context of Iraq. In a letter written in 2004 during the occupation, in response to a parliamentary question submitted by Lord Leicester, the then UK Armed Force Minister Adam Ingram stated that, and I quote, "The ECHR is intended to apply in a regional context in the legal space of the contracting states. It was not designed to be applied throughout the world and was not intended to cover the activities of a signatory in a country which is not signatory to the Convention, the ECHR, I'm quoting here, the ECHR can have no application to the activities of the UK in Iraq because the citizens of Iraq had no rights under the ECHR prior to the military action via the coalition forces. End of quote. So Minister Ingram suggests that a particular action taken by one state in the territory of another state would not be governed by the convention obligations of the first state if the second state is not also a party, presumably what's meant by signatory, to the convention. Under this view, although the concept of jurisdiction under the ECHR isn't limited to a state's own territory, the very applicability of the treaty itself is limited to the overall territory of contracting states. So states acting outside the territorial space of the convention aren't bound by their obligations in it, even if they're exercising effective control over territory or individuals. This is, of course, a severe limitation as far as the convention is concerned, since most of the world's states, including some of the key sites of extraterritorial action by Western European states, fall outside of the legal space of the convention. This concept, although articulated in relation to the convention, is of course of significance more broadly to situations where states act in territory that is not their own and which does not form part of another state that's also bound by the same human rights obligations as they are. This would cover territory of a state that's not a party to the same human rights treaty, such as Iraq and the convention, and non-state territory that is not bound by any human rights treaties at all. It would also cover territory of a state that is party to the same treaty but subject to different obligations under it, whether through reservations, declarations, or a divergent position as far as additional instruments such as optional protocols are concerned. This isn't then a rejection of the extraterritorial application of human rights law in general. It's a rejection of human rights norms that have not yet been universally accepted, or at least accepted by a state with sovereignty in the sense of title over the territory concerned, even if they have been accepted by the foreign state acting in that territory. So we might consider the following exclusions that would be potentially affected by this doctrine. No European state currently acting in Afghanistan, or taking action in territorial waters of states off the Horn of Africa with respect to so-called piracy, or taking migration-related action in the territorial waters of North African states in the Mediterranean, would be bound by the ECHR. No action in the high seas, obviously, or off the coast of Western Sahara, a non-state territory, whether piracy or migration-related, is covered by any human rights obligations whatsoever. Any military incursions by neighbouring states across the borders with China wouldn't be covered by their obligations under the ICCPR, or in the case of Russia, its obligations under the ECHR as well. Israel wouldn't be bound by any of its international human rights obligations with respect to the Palestinian territories. This, of course, sets up a two-tier system of human rights protection. States may act abroad in a manner that impacts on human rights, but such actions should only be regulated by human rights obligations if the norms were already in operation. Such a system echoes legal distinctions operating in the colonial era in levels of civilization as between the metropolis and the colony as far as the level of rights protection is concerned. Indeed, with the ECHR, the distinction in rights protection necessarily operates according to a European, non-European distinction. Occupied Northern Cyprus, yes. Occupied Iraq, no. That said, it will be recalled that the Colonial Extension Clause model under Article 56, adopted in some early human rights treaties, while somewhat similarly affirming a notion that treaties would not automatically apply in colonies, at least provided that application could be triggered if the state decided on an extension. Here, by contrast, there is no possibility of applicability. Now, the possibility of making this argument about a limitation on the extraterritorial application of the convention is rooted In a dictum by the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights in the Bankovic decision I mentioned. In that case, the court stated, and I quote, "The convention applies in essentially regional context, notably in the legal space, the espace juridique, of the contracting states. The convention was not designed to be applied throughout the world, even in respect of the conduct of contracting states." And you can see how some of this language was adopted by Minister Ingram in his statement. I'll return to the use of this concept in Alskany in a moment. First of all, though, the third general contested issue that needs to be flagged up relates to the definition of the state agent or the individual trigger for extraterritorial jurisdiction. In the Alskany litigation in the English courts, a distinction emerged between two different conceptions, narrow and broad, of the test for jurisdiction on this basis. A narrow conception defines state agent jurisdiction extraterritorially as control over individuals only in the context of state-run facilities such as ships, embassies, and, as affirmed in Alskany, detention facilities. The broad basis, by contrast, defines this trigger as such control over individuals shorn of any broader context of state-run facilities. And this broader definition does seem to echo the jurisprudence on this topic, where the heading of jurisdiction has been affirmed either in circumstances that don't necessarily involve state-run facilities, or in circumstances that do, but where this involvement was never presented as a necessary prerequisite for the finding of jurisdiction. The fourth and final general issue that I need to flag up relates to the colonial clause I mentioned earlier. In many cases, states that had or still have overseas territories exercised or do exercise a degree of control over them and the people within them on an individual level so as to meet, as a matter of general factual reality, the jurisdiction test for applicability contained within the ECHR and its protocols. This raises the question as to whether these treaties would therefore apply on the jurisdiction basis, even if a colonial extension clause activation hasn't been made. This issue came before the European Court of Human Rights in two cases relating to Macau and Hong Kong before the handovers to China, when they were, of course, under Portuguese and British sovereignty. The court held in those cases that for overseas territories, the only way the convention can apply is through a colonial clause declaration. This position, despite my best efforts, was affirmed in a case I was involved in the English courts, Quark, concerning the application of the UK Human Rights Act to South Georgia, a UK overseas territory next to the Falklands. The case concerned the extension of the property right under the separate protocol to the convention, which had an equivalent extension clause to Article 56 in the convention itself. And in what seems like an administrative oversight in the FCO, the convention had been extended, but not the protocol. And the question then was whether, because of the degree of control exercised in this area, the obligations in the protocol could be applicable. And the House of Lords held that absent a declaration, the protocol didn't extend to South Georgia, regardless of whether the UK exercised effective control there. So much then for the general background contested issues, which, as I'll demonstrate, then become significant when we look at the treatment in Alskany. Now I'll return to the invocation of these issues in the broader legal framework and how they were applied in the Alskany litigation, reviewing initially how this was done in the English courts and then at Strasbourg. Now, five of the six deaths at issue in Alskany involved shooting in the streets or in buildings where UK soldiers were temporarily present. Before the English courts, applicability in relation to these incidents was considered as a matter of the spatial territorial trigger. Did the UK exercise control over the area where the incidents took place so as to trigger its obligations in relation to them. The sixth death, the result of maltreatment by UK soldiers, occurred while the individual, a hotel receptionist called Baha Musa, was being held in a UK detention facility. Before the English courts, applicability in relation to this incident was considered as a matter of the personal individual state agent authority trigger, the UK exercising control over him directly. What then were the findings of law in relation to these facts initially by the English courts? Well, in the first place, as a matter of general principle, that dictum from Bankovic that I mentioned, linking the meaning of jurisdiction in human rights law to the meaning in general international law, was affirmed at all stages and considered to be a generally operative principle to bear in mind when thinking about the meaning of the trigger. On the trigger for jurisdiction based on control over territory, Lord Brown, for the majority in the House of Lords decision, accepted the UK submission that this trigger applied only to actions in the territory of other states also parties to the convention, applying the espace juridique limitation that I mentioned earlier. As Iraq obviously was not such a party, UK action there was not covered. Now, there were several reasons why the English courts held that this was in operation. The main significant one for the purposes of the later decision in Strasbourg concerns a dictum from the earlier Strasbourg decision relating to the Turkish occupation of northern Cyprus and how this was subsequently addressed in the Bankovic case. In Cyprus and Turkey, the court, having held that the convention applied to Turkey, then went on to say, and I quote, that the court must have regard to the special character of the convention as an instrument of European public order. Having regard to the applicant government's continuing inability to exercise their convention rights in northern Cyprus, the applicant government was the government of Cyprus. Any other finding, that's to say finding that doesn't trigger Turkey's obligations in northern Cyprus, would result in a regrettable vacuum in the system of human rights protection in the territory in question by removing from individuals there the benefit of the convention's fundamental safeguards and their right to call the high contracting party to account for a violation of their rights in proceedings before the court, end of quote. Now, in Bankovic, as one part of their arguments that the NATO bombing constituted the exercise of extraterritorial jurisdiction, the applicant suggested that if the court concluded in the negative on this point, this would leave a regrettable vacuum in the convention system of human rights protection and would therefore raise the same concern that the court had regarded as legitimate in the earlier Cyprus and Turkey decision. The court in Bankovic responded by emphasising that in Cyprus and Turkey, of course, it was concerned with a specific type of vacuum created where a population reside in a state that's already a party to the convention and therefore have already been given rights under it, but then that state is unable to secure the rights because the territory is occupied by another contracting state. The court in Bankovic asserted that this type of vacuum was entirely different to that being suggested by the applicants in Bankovic, presumably because the then FRY was not a party to the convention. The court then went on in Bankovic to make its legal space remark that the convention operates in essentially a regional context, notably in the legal space of the contracting states. The FRY clearly doesn't fall within this space, and I quote, the convention was not designed to be applied throughout the world, even in respect of the conduct of contracting states. Accordingly, the desirability of avoiding a gap or vacuum in human rights protection has so far been relied upon by the court in favour of establishing jurisdiction only when the territory in question was one that, but for specific circumstances, would normally have been covered by the convention, end of quote. In Alskaney, the government argued, and the divisional court held, that it was necessary to establish this particular underlying reason, avoiding a vacuum in this type of vacuum in human rights protection within the Council of Europe when one contracting state acts in another. You have to establish that as being present in order for extraterritorial jurisdiction to exist, at least on the basis of control over territory. For the divisional court in Alskaney, what is critical is how the vacuum consideration invoked in Cyprus and Turkey was then treated in Bankovic. This treatment, according to the divisional court, changed everything. Although in Bankovic the vacuum consideration was raised by the applicants in a form to assist them, i.e. is a good policy reason for finding the exercise of jurisdiction, actually what happened, according to the divisional court, was that it was turned against them by the court for its true import, the true import being that actually it was a requirement for jurisdiction to subsist. Now, actually, this is only a finding before the divisional court. The House of Lords rejected applicability on the basis of territorial control, again because of the espace limitation, but not for this reason, for other reasons, which I can discuss in questions if anyone is interested. The key thing, though, is that when things get to Strasbourg, Strasbourg rejects an espace juridique limitation in general terms on the basis of a rejection of this notion that the vacuum consideration from the earlier case law requires it. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Before turning to it, we have to review, first of all, what the English courts had to say about the alternative base for extraterritorial jurisdiction, control based on individuals. Now, on this heading of jurisdiction, the arguments by the UK government and the findings by the English courts varied significantly as the cases went through the three different stages, reflecting the debate I mentioned earlier about the narrow or broad bases for jurisdiction. Both these conceptions of the individual or state agent authority basis for jurisdiction were sufficient to establish jurisdiction in relation to the facts of the case, since Baha Moussa clearly was in a UK facility, as well as having control exercised over him on an individual level. The difference, though, between them is clearly relevant to other situations, and so the choice made between them in the Alskaney litigation is of broader significance. Initially, the divisional court defined this trigger as control in narrow circumstances, not control per se, control in state-run facilities, ships, embassies, detention facilities. The UK government accepted this finding, but the Court of Appeal then adopted a broader notion of control over individuals by foreign state agents in potentially any situation. The House of Lords overturned the Court of Appeal, however, adopting the narrower formulation from the divisional court. But also, after that ruling by the divisional court, there was agreement between the parties that this trigger for jurisdiction, however narrowly or broadly defined, wasn't limited to action taken in the territory of a party, of a state also a party to the convention. So everyone agreed that this heading of extraterritorial jurisdiction is not restricted by the espace juridique consideration. As a result of this finding by the English courts, the Human Rights Act was accepted to be applicable in relation to the death of Baha Moussa, and that led to the public inquiry that issued its report in September of this year. The applicability of the convention to this particular incident wasn't therefore brought before the court in Strasbourg. However, what the court said about the law generally and its application to the facts that were before it does actually have a bearing on this heading of jurisdiction. What then did the Grand Chamber hold on the law in this area? First of all, very importantly, there was the notable omission of a clear affirmation that the meaning of jurisdiction under the Convention should somehow reflect that in general public international law. We do then seem to have a clear departure from the earlier Bankovic formulation, which arguably brings things more clearly within what actually the Strasbourg Court and other authoritative bodies have said on this issue, approaching the question of jurisdiction simply as a factual test, regardless of whether the facts are pursuant to a lawful entitlement or not, which is presupposed by this notion that it's compliant with the law of jurisdiction. So the court held that Turkey's presence in northern Cyprus constituted the exercise of jurisdiction for ECHR purposes because of the degree of control exercised, stressing that jurisdiction could subsist on this basis regardless of the exercise of the legality of the exercise of control. Of course, this is in the backdrop of the general view taken that this was an unlawful occupation. Clearly, the notion that human rights obligations don't apply if the action in question is not itself pursuant to a legal obligation is perverse. Equally, to say that to constitute jurisdiction for the purposes of the applicability of human rights obligations, action need not constitute a valid exercise of jurisdiction in general international law terms or in a more broader sense be legally authorised, is not to say that action with this lawful basis can't also constitute jurisdiction in human rights law. All it suggests that we can't find the meaning of jurisdiction in human rights law from a different concept with the same name in another area of international law. What then are the Grand Chamber's finding on the scope and meaning of the extraterritorial triggers for jurisdiction? I'll begin with the state agent individual control basis for jurisdiction. Although, as I mentioned, the death of Baher Moussa in the UK military base wasn't before the court, the Grand Chamber nonetheless proceeded to offer a general summary of the case law in this area, which is significant because in some respects it seeks to offer greater clarity about and attempt to identify the underlying principles that can explain the findings in the disparate Strasbourg case law on this issue. In this way, the judgment compares with the earlier Bankovic decision, where the court attempted a similar exercise. But what's significant is that in Alskaney, a potentially broader scope of applicability seems to present itself in the court's overview. The court offered three different subcategories within the general category of jurisdiction defined as control over individuals exercised by state agents. First, certain acts performed by diplomatic or consular agents. Second, and I quote, when, through the consent, invitation, or acquiescence of the government of that territory, it, the foreign state, exercises all or some of the public powers normally to be exercised by that government, end of quote. The third category is articulated by the court as the use of force by a state's agents operating outside its territory, bringing an individual under the control of the state's authorities and therefore its jurisdiction. And this principle, the court said, has been applied when an individual is taken into the custody of state agents abroad. According to the court, the rights of individuals held in UK military facilities like Baha Moussa would seem to come under this subheading, since the court invokes another case about the UK in Iraq, which led to an earlier Strasbourg decision, Al-Sadoun, as an example of this subcategory of extraterritorial jurisdiction based on state agent control, describing that case as one where, and I quote, the court held that two Iraqi nationals detained in British-controlled military prisons in Iraq fell within the jurisdiction of the UK, since the UK exercised total and exclusive control over the prisons and the individuals detained within them, end of quote. What then of the question as to whether this heading of jurisdiction has to involve control over individuals in the broader context of state-run facilities? Do we need to see that extra element or can we focus on simply on the situation of control over the individuals? Well, the court offered the following observation in relation to the state agent control basis generally. The court said, and I quote, "It does not consider that jurisdiction in these cases arose solely from the control exercised by the contracting state over the buildings, aircraft, or ship in which the individuals were held. What is decisive in such cases is the exercise of physical power and control over the person in question," end of quote. This suggests, certainly, that extraterritorial jurisdiction may not subsist simply because the state operates facilities abroad. There has to be also physical power exercised over individuals within those facilities in order for such treatment to be regulated by the Convention. What's left open, however, is whether the exercise of this physical power outside of state-run facilities would also be covered. Another significant observation made in relation to the state agent control basis for extraterritorial jurisdiction is the court's statement that it's clear that whenever a state, through its agents, exercise control and authority over an individual, the state is under an obligation to secure to that individual the rights and freedoms under the Convention that are relevant to the situation of that individual. In this sense, therefore, Convention rights can be divided and tailored. And in using that phrase, divided and tailored, the court is referring back to the Bankovich decision and a dictum within it that suggests an all or nothing model for applicability. If you can't apply all of the Convention in its entirety, you're not in a position to do it because of the nature of your presence, the degree of control you exercise. Therefore, it would be inappropriate to have the Convention applicable. The state would be obliged to do things it's actually not in a position to implement. And here we get the suggestion, which echoes a dicta from Stephen Sedley's decision in the English courts, that actually it is possible to think about a disaggregated idea of the obligations, focusing in on those that are relevant to the particular nature of control exercised over the individual. It has to be said, however, that the Bankovich dictum was actually only made in the context of control over territory, whereas here, of course, the court is talking about control over individuals. Turning to the territorial control basis for the exercise of extraterritorial jurisdiction, a significant finding here is that the court affirms that it's simply a question of fact, implying a rejection that the factual situation also has to be pursuant to an entitlement in general international law, that's to say, in some way reflecting the international law of jurisdiction. It's also notable that the court doesn't include a capacity to exercise civil administration as a requirement of this test, something which was suggested by the court in Bankovich and affirmed by the English courts, including the majority in the House of Lords in Alskane. So it suggests potentially a lower threshold of control of the territory, which may include the exercise of civil administration, but doesn't have to. On Article 56 declarations, I'm conscious of the time, essentially the court here adopts the conventional view that I mentioned earlier, affirmed in the English courts and in previous Strasbourg decisions, that for overseas territories, an extension declaration is the only possibility. There is no other route into applicability through territorial control. This, of course, creates an anomalous situation where a state will be bound by equivalent obligations under those treaties that don't have colonial clause provisions like the ICCPR, but won't be bound by the equivalent obligations in the Convention simply because of the absence of a declaration. And of course that bites when there is a difference in remedies, with remedies being more enhanced in relation to the Convention as distinct from covenants. And arguably that's one of the reasons why the UK government has been reluctant to allow the right of individual petition before the Human Rights Committee, as distinct from being able to take a case to Strasbourg. This is one of the areas, like the law of self-determination, where there would be a real difference in being able to do that. On the issue of the espace juridique limitation I mentioned earlier, I mentioned that the Divisional Court accepted the government's argument that was invoked in relation to the desirability of avoiding a vacuum in protection, that was somehow transformed into a requirement that the Convention only applies on the basis of territorial control if it's necessary to avoid a vacuum in protection when action is taken in another contracting party to the Convention. The Court rejects that as a basis for adopting an espace juridique limitation. That said, it doesn't reject the notion of that limitation in all circumstances. So although, as the Court says in Alskeini, and despite what the UK government argued about Bankovic, this limitation has never been applied to refute applicability so far before the Court, the way the Court deals with it in Alskeini doesn't rule out its relevance potentially in future cases. Finally, briefly on the application of this test to the facts, here the challenge is that the Court does not offer a clear explanation of whether it's rooting applicability on the territorial basis of control or the individual basis of control. Throughout the litigation in the English courts, it was assumed that the only way rights could be operable in this context was on the basis that the area in question met the trigger based on territorial control. And indeed, the Court in Alskeini reviews the case law in this area and offers its view on its meaning. When it comes to actually applying the law to the facts, however, the Grand Chamber focuses actually on authority and control over individuals. And so what we actually see is a case that had up until that point been regarded as a case about the territorial control trigger, it seems, being eventually determined on the alternative basis of control over individuals. So we're left with some uncertainty, therefore, as to whether and to what extent the territorial control basis applies in contexts like the occupation of Iraq, and having ultimately to fall back on the earlier cases relating to Turkey in northern Cyprus, which were more clearly rooted in defining extraterritorial jurisdiction based on control over territory. I think I should probably stop there to allow time for questions, but I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts as well on this very important case. Thank you.